Today at Reader's Corner, Sam Keen, author of The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code.
DNA is like a language, and genes are more like a story with DNA as the language that the story's written in. So I think that's a good distinction to keep in mind. It's really your genes and your environment working together to make you who you are. It's not nature or nurture. It's both working together. The next important stage of DNA research may really lie in doing this work on what we traditionally don't think of as genes.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Anyone who studied Mendel's P experiments in high school knows they marked the founding of genetics, but few truly understand the enormity of Mendel's discoveries or their deep and profound connection to our molecular identity. In The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code, Sam Keen uses Mendel's story, along with dozens of other true yet mind-boggling tales, to explain how DNA affects humanity's past, present, and future. From a propensity to hoard cats, to identical twins who are anything but identical, to a violinist with freakishly flexible fingers, The Violinist's Thumb offers a window into the mysteries of life and the science behind them. In easy-to-understand language, Mr. Keen guides us through many of the oddities buried deep in our genomes and shows how recent advances have allowed us to make sense of it all. Sam Keen was a runner-up for the National Association of Science Writers Award for the Best Young Science Writer. His work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Slate, The New Scientist, and other publications. Mr. Keen was a guest on our show in 2010 to discuss his previous book, The Disappearing Spoon and Other Tales of Madness, Love, and the History of the World from the Periodic Table of the Elements. He joins us today by phone from Washington, D.C. Sam Keen, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Hello, thanks for having me back.
So this is a book about DNA. Let's start with the basics for 101 biology. What exactly is DNA? Is it possible to give a simple description?
DNA is basically a chemical inside your cells. It's a thing. You can get it stuck to your fingers. And the basic job of DNA is to store information and to be able to pass that information from a parent to a child. And what DNA does is it builds things that make your cells go. It builds proteins and other things that you need in order to run your cells. A very closely related idea is genes. And people hear about DNA and genes all the time. And sometimes we think about them kind of interchangeably. But there is a distinction between the two things. Again, DNA is a physical thing. Genes are made of DNA, but in some ways they're better thought of as a little more conceptual, a little more abstract. And the way I like to think about the difference is that DNA is like a language, and genes are more like a story with DNA as the language that the story's written in. So I think that's a good distinction to keep in mind between the two.
Very good. So Watson and Crick are someone we all know who've lived in the 20th and the 21st century, because in 1953, they discovered the structure of the DNA. But you take us way back to these monastic scientists, Miescher and Mendel, who really played a role like hundreds of years ago in getting Watson and Crick where they would eventually be. Help us understand the connection between this long string of scientists, especially Mendel and Miescher, and how that leads up to what Watson and Crick finally do.
As you said, Miescher and Mendel were working in the 19th century, you know, the 1860s or so, and they led kind of startlingly parallel lives in some way. I think a lot of people know the basic story about Gregor Mendel. He discovered what genes were by working with pea plants in the garden at his abbey. He was a monk in an abbey, and he studied how pea plants, traits like whether they were tall or short or had green peas or yellow peas. And it was very groundbreaking work, except no one really quite understood it at the time, and he sort of died unknown. There were some scandals he was involved in, having to do with government officials. So he was kind of known for bad things, but he wasn't known for his science. And it wasn't until about 30 or 35 years later that people realized the really important work, the fundamental work he'd done. There was kind of a parallel story with Miescher. Johann Miescher was the man who discovered DNA. He was the first one to isolate the substance inside cells. He was working with wounds, bandages from soldiers at a nearby hospital with the pus, basically, and the bandages, and he was isolating DNA from that. And much like with Mendel, he got credit for discovering this, but people really didn't understand why it was important or what good DNA was. And for a long time, no one linked it to the idea of heredity, and so no one linked Miescher or Mendel's work together. And it actually wasn't until right before Watson and Crick discovered the double helix structure of DNA that scientists finally had good, strong proof that DNA was involved with heredity at all. So there was about a century gap there where we knew some things about genetics, but we really didn't know that DNA had any role in it. And it's kind of startling for us to realize this today.
You bring to life a parade of scientists leading up to Watson and Crick's double helix structure of DNA discovery. And there's one right in the middle of your parade that really fascinated me, and that's what makes the book so interesting, is the way you bring these folks to life. Sister Miriam. Now, when I think of a sister, a nun, associated with education, I think of one in the classroom teaching. At least that's what happened to me and what happens to a lot of other people. But here we have this nun. First of all, put her in her appropriate place on the calendar, so to speak, and then tell us her role. And in a sense, it's an odd role because it's almost like her being disproven that assists the Watson and Crick venture, as I remember your writing of it.
That's one thing I did try to emphasize throughout the book, was these stories about all the people involved in the work they did. Miriam Michael Stimson was a nun. She was working in the middle and late 1940s on DNA. You know, she was getting patents for different things. She did some good work. Unfortunately, she made kind of a big mistake when it came to the structure of the letters in DNA, the A, the C, the G, and the T. Scientists didn't quite know what exactly those molecules looked like at the time. And she did some research that suggested they had a different shape than some people thought. And because they had a different shape than a lot of people thought, they didn't quite fit together like they would in a normal double helix. And just because they were kind of too jagged or too large, they just didn't fit smoothly together like, you know, puzzle pieces would, kind of like what we think about with this nice, sleek double helix molecule today. They just, again, didn't fit together based on her work. And there were a lot of scientists, Watson and Crick among them, who were very confused by the whole thing and actually were kind of frustrated enough to kind of say, you know, to heck with everything and kind of throw it all away. They just were so frustrated. And eventually, as you said, they had to disprove the work of Miriam Michael Stimson in order to move forward with this. And this was really hard for her to take. You can imagine with any scientist, if you've kind of dedicated a lot of your research career to something, to be disproven so dramatically can kind of be hard to take. But I think really to her credit, after she was disproven, she went back out and did more work and really ended up providing a lot of important confirmation for the idea of the double helix. So she was one of my favorite characters in the book, both for the fact that she, you know, was kind of brave and strong enough to rebound the way she did. And I think she also just led a really interesting life. You don't think about nuns really doing this kind of research, especially she, for instance, had to wear her habit all of the time according to her orders, rules, and regulations, which meant she had this enormous hood that she had to wear in the lab all the time. I mean, imagine trying to do work with this hood on. She couldn't drive because she didn't have any peripheral vision in the hood. So I really think she was one of the more interesting characters in the book.
You're listening to Sam Keen. He is the author of The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. Now, let's come up to date with the Human Genome Project, which was launched in 1990. Help us understand what that is, and the Parallel Project, the Celera Corporation, if I have it right, was also formally launched in 1998. Those two things are working side by side, and in a sense, I guess, eventually have something to do with what you eventually decided to do, which was examine your own DNA. And we're going to talk about that later, but if you could at least do the Human Genome Project for us.
The Human Genome Project was basically supposed to be kind of the Manhattan Project of biology. It was a really big government project, and the goal was to sequence all human DNA. So basically, you want to look at all human DNA and read the order of the letters in the DNA. And hopefully from that, you can get an idea of what that DNA does. You're basically trying to read the instructions in our DNA. And as you said, this got going right around 1990, and the government was working on it for a number of years. But because it was such a big project, and because genetic technology wasn't as advanced then, it was kind of lumbering along. And there were some people who were kind of critical that it wasn't moving fast enough and so on. But, it, you know, it was going along at an okay pace until a man named Craig Venter came up with the idea of sequencing the human genome much faster and for a small fraction of what the Human Genome Project through the government was going to cost. And he founded, or co-founded, I should say, he had a lot of partners working with him, but he co-founded a company that was going to do this work and basically try to demolish the government's Human Genome Project. And after that, there was really a kind of a nasty fight between the two groups as they raced to sequence the human genome. And a lot of really fundamental, very important work came out of this race between the two groups. But there was a lot of bitterness and a lot of anger and a lot of rivalry between them. You know, I feel like I have to be even careful sometimes talking about it because there are scientists today who are still very angry about it, especially people who are angry at Venter. He's not a very popular person in a lot of circles to this day because he made so many people angry with his pronouncements, and, you know, they accuse him of having a large ego and all these other things, his aggrandizement and all of the work he did. And I really just think it's a fascinating, fascinating story, which is why I made it one of the chapters in the book about how something like this that you would think about as this really grand, noble experiment ended up kind of turning into this, you know, kind of petty rivalry among different groups of scientists.
So what's the marketplace look like today when it comes to your deciding that you want to have your genome mapped, where you go and how do you do that?
Well, there are different groups doing different types of work. There are the kind of pop genetic testing services like Decode or 23andMe. And what they can do is give you kind of a quick and dirty overview of your gene. They can look at certain traits that are pretty easy to tell. They can tell if you're a carrier for certain genetic diseases. They can help trace your ancestry and things like that. And a lot of people have done that because it's just sort of fun and interesting to look at your genes in that way and try to figure out certain things about yourself. There are also groups of scientists who are doing work, and they take a little more thorough look at your DNA. It costs more for them to do this, obviously, but they get a better picture of what your DNA is like. And that was really, this kind of work is one of the reasons I was excited to write the book, because they're able to do things not just in medicine, which is what people normally think about with genetics, but they're able to look at things like archaeology and how human beings spread across the globe and our deep history, a lot of the lost stories of humankind history. These scientists are really able to read for the first time in these projects where they're really getting to figure out how to read our DNA, large volumes of it, very, very quickly. So there's a lot of really exciting work going out there in all of these different fields.
But even once you submit yourself to one of these DNA tests and discover something about yourself or your genes, your family history. You point out a number of times toward the end of your book that there's a lot of other things going on as well, including a somewhat radically different environment in which we live.
Yeah, that is one of the themes I did try to emphasize throughout the book, is that it's really your genes and your environment working together to make you who you are. It's not just one or the other. It's not nature or nurture. It's both nature and nurture working together. And so if you have a susceptibility for a certain disease, you know, it's not like you're sentenced or condemned to automatically get that disease. There are a lot of other things that you have to take into account. I actually found this when I got my own genome looked at by a top genetic testing company, because I found out I had a susceptibility for Parkinson's. And it was really hard for me to deal with at first because my grandfather had it, and I had a lot of bad memories of it. But the more I learned about my DNA and how DNA works in general, the more I realized that I really didn't have to be as afraid of DNA as I was before. And so I'm glad I ended up getting my genes tested and looking at them in the end.
Well, and I think at one point you say, our DNA does circumscribe us, but we fall within a range of possibilities.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it is, you know, based on how tall I am and quick I am, you know, I'm not going to be, say, an NBA basketball player. But I can do things, and it's really up to my temperament and personality to get as much as I can out of my talent. So again, it's your genes working with your environment to really make you the person you are.
Well, let's talk about the book's title. Why choose The Violinist's Thumb as the title for this book? Or I shouldn't say why. You can figure that out. But tell us what's behind choosing The Violinist's Thumb.
The Violinist's Thumb refers to the story in the book about Niccolo Paganini, who's usually considered the greatest violinist who ever lived. He was playing for popes and kings and Napoleon in the early 1800s in Europe, traveling all over to huge crowds. And there were always rumors he had sold his soul to Satan for his musical talent. That's how good he was at playing the violin. And one of the reasons he was so good was he had these kind of freakishly flexible fingers. He could just twist them into all sorts of different positions, and he could spread them incredibly wide. He could just do things with his hands that lesser violinists simply could not do. And that's one of the reasons why he was such an amazing violinist. And from a modern perspective, it's almost certain that Paganini had a genetic disorder of some sort, and that's what led to his hands being so flexible. And I chose it as the title story for a few reasons. One reason was that it just did a good job. It was a good example of the kind of history that I was trying to get at in the book, a story about someone famous and kind of looking at their life in a little different way, from kind of a different perspective. And that's really what I tried to do with all of the stories in the book, is look at important incidents in human history, but through a little different lens, through DNA and through genes, things like that. The other reason I chose it was that with Paganini, it wasn't just his hands. He was also a very hard worker, and he was very passionate about music. So it was his genetic endowment working with his temperament that really made him the great musician he was. So once again, it was his genes and his environment working together that really made him the wonderful musician that he was.
But I gather Paganini never had a clue that this was a genetic disorder of some kind. And in fact, didn't he actually go along with the line that he sold his soul to the devil or something?
Yeah, he really didn't, no one did, in fact, really had any idea about what genes were at the time, and they really hadn't even described the condition he probably had until a long time after he died. So, you know, he was taking typical medicines of the time that had tons of mercury in them or arsenic or other things, and they probably ended up doing more damage in the long run than they did good in the short term. But still, he led this really fascinating life. As you said, he kind of sort of played up the rumors sometimes that he had, consorted with devils or things like that. And, you know, he wasn't above taking advantage of those rumors, because as soon as he kind of spread them about himself, or let them be spread about himself at least, you know, that made people interested, and so he would get even bigger crowds and things like that. So really a fascinating life overall.
You're listening to Sam Keen. He is the author of The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. You mentioned the story of the survivor of the Hiroshima bomb in your book. He lived for another 65 years after being right smack dab in the middle of that radiation. I assume that there's a story there as well about gene mutation.
His name was Tsutomu Yamaguchi, and he had the unfortunate luck of being temporarily stationed in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and he wasn't far from where the atomic bomb went off. He saw the mushroom cloud and everything. And so he was very badly burnt in that. He got radiation poisoning, and he was kind of wandering around Hiroshima for a few days till he finally found a train that was leaving, and he decided he was going to get on it no matter what. Got on the train, which took him to his hometown, which unfortunately happened to be Nagasaki. So he got off just not long before the other atomic bomb went off. So he's one of the few people who were around Hiroshima and Nagasaki on both days when the atomic bombs went off. He's kind of one of the unluckiest people of the 20th century. But the kicker on the story was, as you said, he lived an extra 65 years beyond that, all the way until 2010. And I used the story in the book to explain about DNA repair mechanisms. Because radiation, when it attacks you and does harm to your body, one thing it really does is it scrambles your DNA. It causes mutations inside you. But Yamaguchi obviously had a good DNA repair mechanism inside him. And that's one of the reasons why he was able to live so long, was he had these enzymes and these proteins inside his cell that were able to mend his DNA when it suffered mutation. So it's another example of kind of using history to illustrate the scientific book.
So you talk about the crazy cat lady. Who would have thunk that when we hear the news every now and then of these folks who hoard these cats, that we might have a genetic disorder involved here?
it's kind of an odd story, because it's about the DNA, not of human beings, but it's about the DNA of another creature that kind of interacts with us in a weird way. It's about a parasite called Toxoplasma. Toxoplasma is a cat parasite. That's where it likes to be. That's where it's most comfortable and happy, is inside cats. Sometimes, though, it finds itself outside of cats if the cat dies or something like that, and it has to find a new host. And one of the hosts it has found to be very welcoming is mice. And the reason why is, once Toxo gets inside mice, it goes straight for the mouse's brain, and it kind of alters their behavior in very strange ways. If a mouse has Toxo inside its brain, they're actually attracted to the smell of cat. They actually move toward the smell of cat. And then, the cat pounces on it, eats it, and the Toxo ends up back inside the cat, which is exactly where it wanted to be. Now, this intersects with cat hoarders, possibly, because Toxo can infect not only mice, it can infect human beings as well. And we know that once Toxo gets inside humans, it goes straight for the brain, and it goes into a part of our brain called the amygdala that really deals with emotions and emotion processing. And the really eerie part about the whole thing is that if you look at the DNA of Toxo, of this little parasite, it's actually stolen this gene that helps produce dopamine, which is a brain chemical inside us. So when we smell cats, when we smell the odor of cats, it seems that this gene turns on and starts pumping out dopamine inside our brain. And you have to be a little careful, because scientists haven't done controlled studies on this, but it does seem to provide a plausible biological basis for why people hoard cats. You know, people hoard other things, other animals sometimes, but it's most often cats that they hoard. And this, again, provides a little bit of a biological basis for why that might be the case.
You write about scientists' obsession with retroactively diagnosing dead celebrities. Is it possible to get an accurate diagnosis decades or even centuries after a death? And I know you talk in your book about Abraham Lincoln. Maybe you could use that as an example.
Yeah, it's not just scientists. I think lots of people are obsessed with it. I admit I'm a little obsessed with it, too. I'm kind of a sucker for any paper that talks about, you know, why some emperor died of this and not this or something like that.
Sure.
And DNA has really kind of infiltrated the field because it seems to offer a very clear way to decide someone had a genetic disorder or they didn't have a genetic disorder. And they've done tests on mummies, for instance, like King Tut, to try to figure out what exactly he might have died of, things like that. But as you implied there, it's not always clear-cut when it comes to genetics. There's still a lot of interpretation that you have to do. And when scientists were looking at testing Abraham Lincoln DNA to try to figure out if he had a certain disorder called Marfan syndrome, they realized that it wasn't going to be as clear-cut as they imagined, that it was actually going to be kind of harder than they imagined. And when you're talking about doing DNA testing, you inevitably have to destroy small bits of an artifact or of somebody's bones to get the material to do the testing on. And so they decided eventually, the scientists, to not do the testing on Lincoln because they realized they might not get a clear answer even with the power of modern genetics. So I think it's a good cautionary tale that while it seems really tempting to do these genetic tests, you do have to be careful and make sure you're really going to find the answer that you're hoping for.
Earlier this month, about 500 scientists released a series of comprehensive studies looking at how our DNA works. What did they find that is perhaps the next chapter of your book, if there was such a thing?
Yeah, they were dealing with something called, wrongly called junk DNA, which is an old name that got slapped onto non-coding DNA. Coding DNA is the part that we normally think about as a gene. It's the part that makes proteins inside us. Non-coding DNA, though, actually makes up something like 98% of our DNA. And for a long time, scientists didn't have any good idea of what this DNA does, and that's why some called it junk DNA, because maybe it did nothing. Maybe it was completely superfluous. However, this recent study really affirmed what some scientists had suspected for a long time, and that was that this DNA just doesn't do nothing. It really has important roles in DNA regulation, so turning genes on and off at important times or in different types of cells, or turning the volume up or down on certain genes. So we're really finding out that despite the fact that, all this DNA doesn't do anything obvious inside the cell, it probably does have some important roles that we just haven't figured out. So the next important stage of DNA research may really lie in doing this work on what we traditionally don't think of as genes.
It sure sounds like what we know is dwarfed by what we don't know in this subject of DNA and genes.
Yeah, even if you just look at the straight numbers, again, 98% of it is non-coding DNA. So we still have to figure out what most of the rest of that DNA does.
Well, we've run out of time, Sam, but I really want to thank you for coming on to the show. Again, the name of the book is The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Next week, Mark Lynch, author of The Arab Uprising. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.